Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
It's very different, like, writing for kids and actually performing for kids.
Yeah.
I say, okay, let's open it up and get some questions. And one kid puts his hand up, he goes, if you're famous, how come your trainers ain't new?
This week on Walking the Dog, I went for a stroll with multi-talented writer, performer, comedian, rapper, actor, and children's author, Doc Brown, also known by his real name, Ben Bailey Smith. Ben grew up in North London, so he and his adorable Patterdale Terrier Miko met me on London's Hampstead Heath, and we had a fabulous chat about pretty much everything. We talked about his childhood in Willesden with his mum Yvonne and dad Harvey, and his memories of being wheeled around in a matching stroller with his elder sister, the acclaimed author Zadie Smith, as well as his love of performing from an early age, which saw him entering rap battles as a teenager and ultimately the music industry. We also chatted about his move into stand-up comedy and the phone call he got from Ricky Gervais one day, which had a huge impact on his career. Ben also told me about meeting his wife and the insight into women he's had from his two daughters and why he was inspired to start writing for children. His new kids book, by the way, about a budding young stand-up comic, is called Something I Said, and it's out in June, so do pre-order your copy from Amazon. I found Ben fascinating company. He's a really smart, thoughtful bloke, and I loved hearing how his sister Zadie Smith's success had acted as nothing but inspiration to him. And his dog Miko totally had me at hello, even though, spoiler alert, she did at one point run over to a stranger and start licking the coffee out of their cup. Turns out she's a big fan of decaf cappuccinos. I really hope you enjoy my walk with Ben and Miko. If you did, please remember to rate, review and subscribe. I'll shut up now so you can hear from the man himself. Here's Ben and Miko.
Come on, we're going to go for a walk. Remember this park?
You've just missed, Ben, Frank Skinner, who lives up the road.
Did I? And I've not seen him for ages.
And I said, guess who I'm meeting? I'm meeting Doc Brown. And he remembers you very fondly.
Yeah, yeah, we had some good times. Really nice guy.
What a lovely doggy. What kind is that?
She's a Tibetan Terrier.
Oh, beautiful. Isn't that amazing, Ben, that colouring?
Yeah, lovely. She's an unusual. They're harder to get in this colour. You can get them in black and brown. Yeah, so.
Bye-bye. How do you find that? Because you're a recent dog owner. Mm. You know the sort of the interaction there.
Yeah, I'm not always up for it, but sometimes I am. it's like anybody else, I guess. Like, sometimes it's really annoying, especially if you're in a hurry or you're deep in thought. But most of the time, it's nice. I mean, people who have dogs tend to be nice people. So I guess because they've got that desire to care, to be maternal or paternal, you know? So they tend, on the whole, to be nice people. It's just whether you get accosted by, like, a dog bore, you know? I'm not really a dog bore. Like, I don't give that much of a shit, do you know what I mean? Like, but yeah, cool, you know, how old's your dog? Yeah, very cute, la, la, la. But I don't want to get into all that talk about breeds, and I don't really care that much. I just like my dog, do you know what I mean?
Okay, I need to introduce you properly. I'm very thrilled to have the wonderful Doc Brown, aka Ben Bailey Smith. Do you like Ben?
Yeah, Ben's fine, Doc's fine, whatever you prefer.
You don't mind either?
Mm-mm. They're both my name. I mean, I've been Doc since I was a teenager, so it's more than half my life.
And we've got your wonderful dog with us. Do you want to introduce us?
This is Miko. She's a sort of, what would you describe her colour as? Red chocolate?
I'd say sort of russet.
Yeah.
She's autumnal.
She's a Patterdale Terrier.
She's absolutely beautiful. And how old is she?
She's 7 months. She's a very sort of curious, job-worthy busybody. She's got amazing character. But see, Patterdales are they're working dogs, you know. They were bred in the Lake District.
Oh, really?
Yeah, for hunting foxes.
Yeah,
digging up, what do you call fox? I don't know what their little hideouts are called underground.
Oh yeah, they were at dens.
Warrens, dens.
Badgers so, were at
so
Warrens.
A listener will know. A listener who isn't a Londoner will know. So yeah, they were bred for that, so they're working dogs. So you don't really see a lot of Patterdales as pets because they need a mission. Do you know what I mean? It's not even like, you know, you hear dogs need attention. Of course they do, all of them do, because they're all very emotional creatures, but Patterdales also need a mission. So she needs like little tasks. She can't eat out of just a bowl. It has to be like a sort of treasure hunt, do you know what I mean? And with the garden, that's like her fortress. It's like a massive version of her crate where she sleeps, you know? She just patrols the outskirts of it every night and make sure no foxes come in.
I love where you've taken me.
Well, this is the greatest park in London.
So we're in Hampstead Heath. Come on, the lower end. I don't know what bit is this called, Ben, because I think they're divided into sections, yeah, aren't they? But this is my favourite part.
I love all of it. I mean, I spent so much of my childhood here. My dad loved Golders Hill Park on the other side of the heath from where we are. There's a little hill at the top with an ice cream parlour, and that was just like, if he ever took me there, that was like my best Sunday, do you know what I mean?
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's where I sprinkled his ashes, in the lake there where the flamingos come once a year.
I think it's lovely to remember someone, you know, to associate them with a place that made them happy and that you have those memories of them, you know?
Absolutely. And, you know, my family is very, it's very London, man, you know?
Is it?
It's very London-centric. You know, my dad is from South London. My mum moved to South London from Jamaica, late 60s, early 70s.
Oh, Ben.
This looks like a Patterdale.
Is that a Patterdale?
He's got a very long snout. What breed of dog is this here?
It's an Irish Terrier.
Irish Terrier. It's like a long version.
Look how big that dog is, Ben.
Yeah.
That's like me going for a bath.
Yeah. It looks like a hairy sea lion from where we are.
Oh, that's what I look like going for a bath. It's been lockdown, love. Standards have slipped. So, talk me through. You grew up not far from here, because you're in...
Well, I was born in the Royal Free, which is, for anyone who knows Hampstead, it's just at the foot of the park near the station where we met, Hampstead Heath. I went to a school called Hampstead, which wasn't actually in Hampstead, it was in Cricklewood. So yeah, I was always northwest London. Both my parents are South Londoners really, but they both moved north. And yeah, I was born in Kilburn, well, born in, like I say, in the Royal Free, but then grew up in Kilburn.
Yeah.
And Willesden, Kensal Rise.
Were you the youngest?
Middle.
You're the middle.
But I've got a half-brother and half-sister as well, so there's technically five of us.
And were your parents... It's your dad's hobby, is that right?
Yeah.
And your mum, Yvonne?
Mm-hmm.
And what are your memories of your sort of family experience, really? What was the atmosphere like in your home?
Well, we started off on... Well, when we were born, anyway, we were in a council estate on Walsden Lane and that. It was just inside our flat. I'm not talking about the whole estate, but inside our flat, it was just the best place, man. It was the best place to be. Because it was, you know, you go to some of your friends' houses when you're a kid, there's never any visitors. It's always quiet.
Yeah.
You feel like you're going to a museum or something. You know, like Cameron Fry's house in Ferris Bueller. Like, my flat was always just, so much life there, man. So much stories. Jamaicans, Irish, and English, just in and out, in and out. It was a great, great place to grow up. I think so many of my happiest memories are there, even though it's nowhere near the nicest place I've ever lived. Do you know what I mean?
How lovely.
Yeah.
And were you close to Zadie Smith, your sister?
Yeah, we grew up like twins, you know, we're only 18 months or so apart. Yeah, we're in the double pushchair, a little McLaren, you know, stripy blue McLaren. Your Mark II, 79-80 plates. Yeah, we're in the twin, one of them, in the Topsy and Tim, Osh Kosh Bagosh, you know.
What kind of a kid were you? Were you noisy? Or were you
No, I was always the quiet one, always.
Were you?
Yeah.
Oh,
a little boarder.
I love boarders.
Yeah, they all look like little old men, don't they?
I always say, you know, Ben, they're like 1940s dogs.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't you think?
Yeah, when I see a boarder, I always think it's going to say, what, oh? Or something like that.
I think they're like RAF, like we lost a lot of good men out there today.
Yeah. Jolly good.
So go on, so you were, I'm fascinated by that, because I interviewed Alex Horn recently.
Oh, yeah.
On the podcast, and he said exactly that. He said comics and sort of funny people, they're either sort of look at me or observers.
Hmm.
And so do you think you were more of an observer?
Yeah, I've never been a look at me guy. I get very nervous when people look at me, which is, I think, a very, very natural human trait. But I also know that I have a lot to give to people, strangers even, you know? So it's, that's the paradox people like Alex and I will forever be in, you know? Introverted entertainers.
Yeah, do you think you are an introvert then?
Yeah, absolutely. It's sort of masking as an extrovert. But like I say, I don't think that's weird or like fanciful. I think that's a lot of human beings. It's just more extreme if you're an entertainer for a living. Because there has to be an extroverted part that you switch on for your job. You have to have that. You even have to be able to sort of tweak it on and off, just meeting strangers in the street who want to talk to you about your job, you know?
And how do you find that?
I've been really lucky, man. I mean, I don't do all the socials and that, so I've never experienced online abuse. I understand what it is and how many people suffer from it.
Mm.
So I can only go by on the street, and on the street, man, I get a lot of love, man. It's really, really nice, I'm not gonna lie. And the only time it's annoying is if you're in like a mad rush or you're with your kids arguing with like somebody. Do you know what I mean? Like you're having an argument with your mum or something. Do you know what I mean? But most people, I think, in London anyway, have that body language. They're understanding of body language. They can see it's not a good time, you know. Miko, come on. Good girl. Well done. Good girl. Look, there's one there.
Look. Daddy just gave you a treat.
What's that? Where's it gone?
Do you know she's got lovely white teeth because...
Well, I do the toothpaste thing every night. There's this like stuff you just put into their gums on one side and the other, this gel, and then they lick it round.
I need to do that.
It's good.
I didn't do that with my dog, Raymond.
I tried to brush her teeth. It's fucking impossible.
She's really good-natured, I can tell.
She's lovely, man. With, adults, kids and dogs.
Yeah.
I've been super, super blessed. But at the same time, I'm very gentle with her, do you know what I mean?
Are you?
Yeah, because I remember people like when I was younger who like they just beat up their dogs and wrestle with their dogs and that, and then their dogs would bite someone. Like, oh, I can't believe it. Like, mate, have you seen how you are with your dog every fucking day? Kicking it, whacking it with a stick, wrestling like his playtime. Come on, man, what do you think it's gonna do? See someone coming towards you.
So it sounds like you were quite happy as a kid. Did you have...
Yeah, definitely up until sort of 12, 13.
And what was the house style with Yvonne and Harvey? Was it sort of love and boundaries?
I don't really know how to describe it. It was just different. It was quite free, I'd say.
And very artistic and creative.
Yeah, and I think that was maybe just born out of our parents' experiences rather than any obvious creative skill. I mean, when I look back now as an adult, I understand that they had a creative side. You know, my dad took photos, my mum made pottery. But, you know, they were working people. They don't have time to be faffing about with art, you know?
Your mum was a...
She was a social worker.
Yeah.
My dad was in, like, direct sales.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the thing is, their lives, they didn't describe their lives. Their lives were unreal. So that I think that's what made us artists, because it was endless stories. You know, you look at my mum coming over from Jamaica, the journey she took is absolutely mind-blowing. I mean, you can make 100 films about it. And my dad, you know, fighting in the Second World War, being on the beaches at Normandy. He had like 2 lives before I even met him, you know.
That's incredible.
He was 52 when I was born, so he'd already had a life. Whereas my mum was like 21, 22. But she'd already had 2 lives as well, so.
Yeah.
And then they through all the lives that they've had, they meet and get together in that period, coming up to, you know, Thatcher, then the riots in 81, like that period of incredible racial tension, and a sense of like something really dangerous in the air. So that, you know, like that's what we're born into. So it's kind of, it's just been a movie from long before we were born. So it's not like they were 2 artists and they handed down their artistry or whatever. It's more like they were 2 human beings who lived such, I don't know, full lives and unusual lives. You just soak up a bit of that and you'll probably be a writer or a singer or a painter or something.
Yeah, I can see that.
And I look at my half-sister, she's an artist, a painter and a curator, an art professor.
Mm.
My half-brother's a musician, my younger brother's a musician, my sister's an author.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So it's like...
There's some kind of alchemy though sometimes in family, yeah, which I find interesting.
Yeah, you see it in sports, see it in everything. Because there is, it just goes to show you, there is something genetic going on. Just like there is with like mental health and stuff like that.
Yeah.
There's stuff that gets handed down, whether you like it or not. But then you also needs to be nurtured. So it just continues the nature versus nurture debate and leaves you with the same conclusion that it's a bit of both. Like if you're mixed, you don't look like your mum or your dad. Obviously you do want understudy and scrutiny. But at first, when you're looking for who your team is when you're a kid, you don't find that in your house. That's why mixed race siblings, you know, end up really dependent on each other, because that's the first representation they see of themselves. I mean, I've tried to write about it from the start of my career in show business. Even before that, as a rapper, I think it's something I've never stopped writing about. It's just more sort of tied up in the general concept of duality, you know? And the idea that human beings are never just one thing. And being mixed is kind of a physical representation of that.
Yeah.
But that duality is something I've always written about in everything, in my raps, in my comedy, scripts, books. It's always had that thing of rich and poor, black and white.
Yeah.
You know, up and down, good and evil, wrong and right. However you want to look at the differences, but constantly hammering that point home that that's in everybody. There's no one thing. And everything you say that you are, you're still a part of something else. You know, do you know what I'm saying? Like there is no white, there is no black. Like it's all just a construct that's handed down, and now you feel like this is your team or that is your team. It's all nonsense, you know? I did the census the other day, and you can't be black British, which annoyed me, because that's how I would describe myself. I'm of mixed heritage, definitely, but black British is important to me because, you know, I feel British, but, you know, identify as a person of colour. So black British works for me. I'm not saying it should work for anybody else, but I was just a bit disappointed to see that it wasn't on there.
Come on!
Miko! Come! Come on! Miko! Hey, you want to chew?
Were you academic at school?
Nah.
Were you not?
Zadie was, but I was like... I was one of those kids who was... a bit too smart for his own good. So like I got that thing of like, yeah, I mean, geography, I'm not interested. And you know, look what I can do with English. Like, look what I can do with it. I loved English so much. I was just, from a very early age, I was like, can someone explain to me why I'm supposed to give a fuck about science, about Petri dishes or maths? I don't care. And of course, it's a really arrogant approach that like nothing else is important. But at the same time, if you really know that you've got one focus, and I've just always had that. I wasn't sure what I would do with it, but I just thought, this is what I like. I like English, I like drama, and that's it. That's all I want from this. So I wasn't a bad kid per se, but I think I was definitely disruptive, because you get that with smart kids sometimes. They think they're above the lesson, so they sort of belittle it.
Well, I think sometimes with smart kids, particularly kids that are talented in one area, which you clearly were and are, they hyper-focus because they have a passion for something. So you're sort of thinking, I don't want to do this physics stuff because I need to get this thing.
I haven't got time for that. Like, that's why I resent shit now. Like, I resent it now because, like, here's a perfect example, right? I've been making music on and off for half my life, right? And for about 10 years, I've worked with one guy who's like a multi-instrumentalist. He's got his own studio. He's got all the knobs to twiddle that you can dream of, right? And I've worked in and out of that studio for over a decade. I couldn't turn that thing on or off. Like, I couldn't raise a fader and not ruin the song. So I've been in studios for 20 years. Do you know what I mean? I've seen it day in, day out. And I've never learned the first thing. Like, I can just about press record on GarageBand. Do you know what I mean? And this guy, his producer, Mikis, he said to me, I remember him saying one time, like, it's so easy. Look, I'll give you Logic. You download that. I'll get you all the basic equipment. And I can teach you. It's so easy. And I was just like, no, I'm just not going to learn it. He even gave me Logic, and I still haven't learned it, you know? And I said to him, it's just not in me. It's not in my brain. Like, I don't have that understanding, that level of intelligence. And he goes, that's bullshit. Mm. I said, wait. He goes, it's not that you can't do it, because if you put your mind to it, of course you could. Yeah, your issue is you resent spending a minute learning about this shit if you can't write a poem, you know? Like, if it's stopping in your head, if it's stopping you from painting a picture, if it's stopping you from singing a song, or rehearsing a joke, you know, or learning a line, you resent it. And I was like, fuck, that's 100% it. That's exactly it. That's exactly it. The technicalities of my job, I just don't care about. Mm. And as I've got older, I just realized, that's because you're an artist, bro. Like, accept it. I've never wanted to call myself that because it seems so poncy. But it's true. I don't do anything else, and I don't want to do anything else. That's why I have a fucking accountant. That's why I have a fucking agent. Do you know what I mean? That's why I have a music manager. That's why my team is amazing. And I couldn't do any of this without them.
And were you popular then as a kid?
That's a flat no. I was not.
Flat no?
Yeah. I was thinking, like, what? Let's be honest here. Like, what? Like, come on. I had my moments. And I look back and, no, I didn't really. I was super popular in primary school, and then secondary school was just like, nah, it just didn't happen. I was like a proper loser.
Were you?
Yeah. But I think back on it as being kind of cool because I lent into it. Do you know what I mean? Like, I knew my social status, and I wasn't trying to climb the ladder. I was like, I'm good. Like, this is okay. Like, all the people in my year, the cool kids, I'm friends with them now, like, because we've all grown, like, the social status thing has disappeared. That was just a school thing. But it's funny, when I chat to them now, you know, have a beer with them or whatever, I do still look at them and think, you were in that cool sector of our year, you know? The guys who would actually go to raves, you know? The guys who had, like, the good clothes, Machino, and, you know, and the 8-Ball jackets and the Averex, the Air Max 95s. The DJs, do you know what I'm saying? The cool boys. You know what I'm talking about. They tolerated me, but it's not like I would get an invite necessarily to anything good.
Were you confident with women?
No, not at all. No, I sort of just let women do their thing to me when they wanted. I didn't have any moves or, I just, just literally, you know when they say, oh, I got lucky last night, that was literally it. Like, I just get lucky, that's it. There's no skill involved, really. I had my little crew of boys, and there's like five of us, and that was just my world. I didn't feel the need to break out of that. Felt safe within that, and we do like losery type stuff that I look back on very fondly now. So like when all the other boys would go, you know, raving, go labyrinth or something, we would save up our money and buy an ounce of weed, which was like a massive amount of weed for us then, you know, when we were normally smoking like teemps and little bits of hash. Get an ounce of weed, and we would get tickets to King's Lynn from King's Cross, get on the train, or Liverpool Street actually, I think. We'd ride to the station on our bikes, put the bikes on the train, and then we'd go to King's Lynn, then we'd ride another like 25 miles out to the Norfolk coast, and we'd just camp around there, just let off all our steam, but with none of the danger of London and no cool people around. Like, I was writing rhymes at that time, I just kept them to myself.
And tell me when you went to your first, it was like a rap battle, wasn't it? That you started, how old were you, about 16 or something?
Maybe 16, but I'd say probably more like 18.
And with rap and stuff, you would just start writing it in your bedroom, would you do it with other friends?
Or? No, it's completely private. I wrote it down on in little books and kept it completely to myself. It was mainly just about girls at first. And then it become really like political, like protest raps that I never show anybody. So pointless.
So at what point was there a case of being discovered? What happened? Did people, because you started working with Mark Ronson, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, all the music stuff was just amateur, like potluck kind of stuff. So I never made a living off of it. I was, you know, there's always been a rap community as long as I've been around anyway, but it was just very small then. So like early 2000s, it was just like a low-key thing, really. It was UK wide, but you know, no one was really doing big things hot until when like Dizzy came along, probably Roots Maneuver, Rodney P, they were like the biggest guys we had, Skinny Man. But there wasn't a real industry like there is now, you know. So most of what we did was for fun. I used to run a open mic type party out of my friend's record shop in Carnaby Street on Fridays, Friday Night Live at Deal Real. And that was really the making of me, really, as an entertainer, because I was just up there throwing these hip hop nights as a host, you know, keeping the sort of vibe in the room just nice, friendly, bit of humour. Being self-deprecating, you know, I think that was the birth of the stand-up in me. But so I would just do that, and I would occasionally release music to no great fanfare, you know, because I was like, sail or return, you know. I'd ride my bike or around like Soho or Camden or Notting Hill.
And did you go to university?
Selling CDs and records. Yeah, I went to UEA in Norwich for a year to do performing arts. I dropped out at the end of the year, and then I went back and did a social studies course. I think I took a year to work. I think I was working at, is that when I was working at Next? I fucking hated that job so much, man. I don't think there's any job I've hated more than working at Next. I also got...
Why did you hate it?
Retail, man. It's like, ask anyone who works in retail.
I did it. I did the Gap.
It's just horrible. Because you don't just have your boss giving you shit every day. Like every person in there is like your boss, because it's like boss you around. Did they ask you that question they used to ask when you did the interview? Do you consider yourself to be attractive or good looking?
Did they?
Yeah. That's fucked up, isn't it? Now that'd be a court case now, right?
Yes.
They'd be cancelled. They'd lose their job. I got fired in a spectacular way though. So
did you?
I have it. It's a fond memory in some ways.
How did you get fired?
I just had enough taking shit, and you know they play that music. You got that music going around all day long. Somebody else, more pop hits or some shit.
Yeah.
And it would just be the same tape, around 90 minutes, then it would start again. Right? They go round and round. He used to drive me up the fucking wall. One of the songs on there was, "And the sky so blue, sun's gonna shine on everything you do. Don't know why." That fucking dirge. Remember that? And then, like, it came towards the Christmas period, you know, it started that real early. And they said, "Oh, Ben, can you go and change the tape, put the Christmas tape in?" I'd not been there for a year, so I didn't know there was a Christmas tape. I didn't know there was any more tapes. So I was like, what the fuck, there's more tapes? So I went in the back into this little room where they have the microphone. Yeah. So I used to do the announcements as well at the end of the day.
Did
you know?
What did you say?
You know the ones where it's just like, "We're about to close, so take your
bags." I want to do it now. Ben, can you do the announcement, please?
What did I used to say? Ladies and gentlemen, the shop is about to close. Please take your purchases to the nearest counter or something like that. I'm in there and they're like, "Yeah, in the drawer under the mics." I pull open the drawer and there's fucking like about 50 tapes. I'm sure they're all full of shit. More Lighthouse Family or whatever. But just to have something different. Like, why would you not change it?
Yeah.
Your staff are losing their fucking minds, right? Why would you not change it? So, I put on the Christmas tape, but that was really the end of it for me. Like, I remember putting on this hair just thinking, these guys don't care. You know, this is just a horrible job to get out of here. So, I had a big set to with my manager one time, and I'd come back late. I'd been in Manchester, I missed the last train, I had to get a bus. Bus broke down, it was a nightmare. And I wasn't in the mood for getting shit, and he gave me shit. And so at the end of the day, I got on the mic and I, "Miko, what you found? That's gross. Miko, come on, let's walk." So, I just went in there at the end of the day and I got on the mic and I said, "Ladies and gentlemen, the shop's about to close, so please gather up your planned purchases, throw them on the ground because they're not worth anything. They're made by child slaves in Bangladesh. You know, and then they're shipped over here for you to buy an extortionate markup, considering the clothes aren't even as nice as like Gap." And then my floor manager come running. He's like, "You are finished. You are finished." I love it. "You are finished." Like we're in the, I don't know, in the White House or something. Like we're playing with high stakes here. Do you know what I mean? Like it's fucking Succession. You know, like, "Mate, this is next year. I'm a sales assistant. I'm 17. Do you really think I give a fuck? I'm gone." So I felt very rock and roll.
So tell me, I appreciate you said this countless times before, but just in case anyone isn't aware, the Doc Brown moniker, how did that start?
I get asked that question all the time, and it's one of them ones I don't really know the answer to it. How did the nickname start? Does everyone remember? I don't really recall, but I'd imagine it'd be something to do with me being a massive Back to the Future geek and just being a nerd in general. I'd say it's probably some combo of those. Whatever it is, it wouldn't initially be kindly. I don't really know why I retained it. It's a rubbish name.
Do you think so?
Yeah.
I really like it.
But then, like, what's your alternative? Ben Smith. That's even worse. So, like, I've got really boring names. Nothing I can do about it. Not even a Benjamin. Miko, hey! Miko! Miko, leave it! Come here! Oi! Get your snout out. Come here.
I got the sense, just from things you've said in the past and hearing you chat about things, that you kind of felt that you were drawn towards performing arts and stuff like that.
Yeah, from birth, man. Like, I remember being like 5 or 6 and I wanted to be two things, either an actor in Star Wars or a milkman. Yeah, I used to love the milkman. Like, you should just see this mysterious guy, like, just rolling around at 3 miles per hour. just in his, like, tricked out little cart with all these treats on the back. And it didn't feel like no one was telling him nothing. Do you know what I mean? Like, no one was telling him what to do. He seemed free. And that's like, I sometimes look at my career and look at my life now. I feel like I am that milkman, you know? I just love just doing my own thing in my own time, in my own way.
And you've got 2 daughters, haven't you?
Yeah. I couldn't recommend it higher for every single man. Like, the shit I'm learning now, you know, since Me Too, it's about equality. So knowing that as I did innately anyway, I think it's amazing what I've learned on top of that in the last 5 years. Really? Either from just being out there in the world facing outwards, or from my daughters, you know.
And do you think it sounds like
every day is an education?
Well, you grew up in a house with intelligent, strong females
as
well.
Yeah, absolutely. No, look at that.
Oh,
look at
I
that.
Love your dog. What is that?
She's a Carpathian sheepdog. She's from Romania.
Incredible.
She's beautiful.
She's just a rug with legs.
I didn't want to say it. You know, I didn't want to.
But they breed. They live with the sheep, and they just stay with the sheep,
but
they don't do anything.
She's absolutely lovely.
Oh, it's all right. It's decaf coffee.
Miko, hey, nosy.
Miko, Ben, do you want to just say what your dog did? I don't want to shame you.
She went up to the owners of a Romanian sheepdog, which is self-described as a rug on legs. And she started drinking a cup of coffee, which actually belonged to the sheepdog, only in London.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet Plush Care, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
What point did you get into comedy then? Because you were a youth worker as well,
yeah, 2008. Yeah, I was a youth worker while I was doing music. I wasn't earning enough money to live off of music, so I did youth work during the day, part-time, music the rest of the time. But yeah, 2008, February was the first time I stepped on a stage and tried stand-up. Miko, this way!
Miko!
Come on, this way!
And so how did you first get into comedy?
Again, like, it was organic. It was accidental. It was never a plan, ever. I mean, it was a weird situation. Like, while I was doing music, I'd done some stuff for Radio 1 and One Extra that was kind of comedy related, but it wasn't, I didn't do it as me, or I was just writing stuff for this other guy who was had a sort of music and comedy thing on Radio 1 and One Extra. He went off and started working in comedy. I hadn't spoken to him for a couple of years, and he called me and said he'd been working on this show for Lenny Henry for Radio 4. His name was Danny Robbins, and he asked me to help out with some of the lines in the script, because there were some young black characters in there, and he was like, look, I'm not a young black man. So, like, it's a good bit of foresight, I'd say, you know. And he got the BBC to pay me like 200 quid to be a kind of consultant on it.
Yeah.
Then I ended up working on the whole series. It was like a radio comedy show, and Lenny Henry would give me these little walk-on bits, you know, where I'd say a line here or a line there. And that was the start of it, man. It was the producer of that show. He got me working on another couple of comedy shows, writing like comedy music for Radio 4 shows. And then he was the same one who brought me down to this comedy night and pushed me onto stage to try something.
And you must have realised then that you were funny.
Yeah, kind of. I knew that I could hold a crowd, you know, under any circumstances. And that just grew into being comedic, because it's just inherently funny, isn't it? To just be up there trying to avoid disaster. And that's how it began.
But right, were you funny at home, for example, and amongst
your
friends?
Yeah, I was always
friends.
Funny at home.
Were you?
But not so much amongst my friends.
Yeah.
My friends would tell you I was the least funny, am the least funny person in the group. And I would agree. But that's not what the skill is. Miko, leave it. Hey.
when you kind of made the move over to comedy, was it a case of thinking, I'll give this a go, I'm obviously quite good at it, or?
Yeah, I just thought, why not? Yeah. I literally just thought, why not? And I was in desperate need of money, had a baby, had another one on the way.
Mm.
And when these first couple of gigs went well, I just thought, well, there must be something like in rap where you can battle for money. There must be.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? There must be, right? There is in everything.
Yeah.
So I just Googled it, and the first thing that came up was So You Think You're Funny, and it was $5,000, the prize. Whereas I've been battling for like £500 max, you know? So it's like $5,000. I was like, I'm going to do this. So I went in that competition. I ended up getting all the way to the final, and I didn't win, but it is irrelevant because at the final, it's like in a big hall in Edinburgh in the middle of the festival. Yeah. You've got all the agents looking for new talent there. Do you know what I mean? The judges were like Johnny Vegas and like head of Channel 4 comedy and shit. So for me, that was it. It was done. It was a done deal.
Did you really think, oh, I like these guys?
No, I didn't. I never liked comedians.
Really?
Yeah, I never got on with any of them. I ask them, like, I don't have any friends from comedy, and I guess I must be the dick, because I never made friends with anybody. So it must be me. I think I started on the wrong foot. I started off with a big working class chip on my shoulder, like, look at these guys, they're just happy not to get paid and get dicked by their agents and by promoters, and it's like, you lot are mad. I come from rap, like, I want my money now. You know? So I think people thought, he's a bit aggressive. Whereas on the black circuit, it was obviously completely different. They were like, who the fuck you think you are, you know? Little squirt. Comedians are social lepers, you gotta remember that. We're weirdos, right? They're people who have to sort of be alone most of the time to get their job done. They write alone, they perform alone, they travel alone. But their work is about people. So they have to sort of be around people as well, but there's a lecherous side of that. I don't mean in a sexual way, but in like a being like a lech for real human behavior. Do you see what I'm saying? Because then they ape that and turn it back on stage. And I just felt that was an uncomfortable way of living. I wasn't really a fan of it. And of course, there's just a massive amount of jealousy and suspicion because our intellectual property is everything. So there's no, like, you'll notice whenever a comedian gets massive, all the comedians that are still on the circuit are like, oh, he's such a prick. We're going to head up this way.
Yeah. So the comedy thing, actually, but then you must have realised you're good at it.
Yeah. Yeah, I realised quite quickly because my rhythm, because I hadn't watched stand-up before doing it, my rhythm, my whole approach was quite different. And and having rap in there as well, it just sort of snapped people into attention. Do you know what I mean? It's just like, wait, what is this? What is this? Mm. Look at the way he's doing it. It's different. So I wasn't the funniest at first, but I'd have this little sort of trick up my sleeve that would just, I'd capture people's attentions and imaginations. And I remember it was Sean Walsh, actually, who said to me, we were in Bristol, and he'd watched me for the first time, like doing a proper like 20-minute set or something, some bit longer than normal. And he was like, dude, everything you've got is like fascinating, it's great, it's interesting, but you just need way more jokes per, like, you know, mm-hmm. per paragraph. And he was so right. So from there, I sort of streamlined it, and I just made the raps like untouchable, and the bits in between, just I'd make them as real as possible, and keep improvising as well as often as I could. And it just sort of became bulletproof, man. I just started becoming a headline act at all the clubs. And then, yeah, before long, within about 18 months, I was making a very healthy living. It was good. But that build up in the day up until absolutely unbearable. And when you're doing it, you know, at my peak, I was probably gigging like 11 nights a week, which is, you know, there's only 7 nights in a week. But it'd be 11, 12, maybe more gigs, you know, a double up, triple up on nights.
I always find it amazing when Frank says, that we'll meet for lunch and go, I've got a show tonight, you know.
Yeah.
I'm like, how can you just have lunch and act like life's normal?
Well, Frank especially can because, well, number one, he's a genius. Number two, he is incredibly quick-witted. So, like, when he started out, you know, he's one of, in a way, the godfathers of the more modern type of comedy that we've grown up with.
Mm.
But yeah, he was doing, you know, hosting at at nights when he started. So he'd have to do something different every night because the whole audience knew him, do you know what I mean? So he's just so sharp. So I can see why he'd have a more laissez-faire attitude. Plus he's got like 20 years more experience. That said, it doesn't always equal to not being nervous. I know for a lot of people it's still so difficult to build up to a gig. For me, yeah, I found it at times unbearable. Then the other thing was just loneliness. I just get really lonely. That life, shit, you know.
Do you think it can bring on the blues sometimes, that
lifestyle? Yeah, absolutely, especially if you're already prone to it. And I was already prone to like bouts of depression and she's taking a shit. And, you know, anxiety and...
Are you?
Yeah. And I think if you're that type of, you know what the main thing for me is catastrophizing and like, you know, oh my God, these terrible things are going to happen and just getting so caught up in that, you know? And like therapists will tell you, like, has that shit actually happened? You know, not yet. So why are you like letting it distort your daily life? But yeah, I had a lot of that. So I don't think stand-up was a healthy thing for somebody like me because of the amount of time you have to spend alone. And you know, like whenever you're feeling down or you're feeling like life is really problematic, just talking to someone can make a huge difference because you just say the problem and they go, oh yeah, that happened to me. Oh yeah, my brother's going through that or whatever it is, you know. And you immediately go, oh, that's actually really normal. It's fine. I can get through this with the help of other people. But self-will is never going to do it. You can't just do it all on your own. And when you're a stand-up, you do everything all on your own. So, you know, I was forcing my life into this hole wherein I didn't need anybody but myself, and that wasn't a healthy way for someone like me to live. Whereas now making movies and television, it's like, say what you like about it, but it is a team sport, man. You need the other 300 people involved. Every single one of them is vital. No more or less vital than you, you know? So there's this incredible kind of camaraderie. And if you want to be alone, you can be alone, just like in any workplace. Just fuck off for an hour, you know?
So Ricky Gervais had a big effect on you, didn't he? Your career?
Yeah, I mean, massive, man. Like, a Gervais endorsement in comedy terms is like, come on, man. Like... Of anybody to endorse you, what, you're going to get the GOAT, like the UK GOAT.
How did you start working with Ricky then?
YouTube, I think. He's seen some stuff that I'd done on there. Got his guy to call me. Just phoned my phone. It was mad. I was just sat in the garden of my old flat. My phone rang and it was Ricky Gervais. And I didn't believe it was him. I thought it was bullshit. He was like, what's up, Doc? Like that. And I was like, you know, unknown number. I'm like, bro, who is this? He goes, it's Ricky Gervais. And I was like, I think I just hung up. Or I said something and then hung up. And then the phone rang back and it was his guy. And the guy was like, hey, you know me, I'm a friend of so-and-so's. I know so-and-so. And I was like, oh yeah. And he goes, it really is Ricky Gervais. Like he wants to ask you something. And I was like, rah. And I remember exactly what I thought. I remember thinking, whatever he asks me, I'm going to say yes. Like, whatever it is, I'm just going to say yes. It's probably going to be nothing, but I'm just going to say yes. So he comes back on the phone and he goes, hey, I've seen your stuff, man. Really, really funny. He goes, this might be beneath you, which is funny because it's the same thing Mark Ronson said to me. This might be beneath you, but do you want to come open for me at this gig in Norway and see how it goes, like, and you come do some more with me? And I was like, bruv, of course. So the first time I met him, like, he flew me out business class. First time I met him was backstage at the first gig in Oslo, and that was 2012, maybe, yeah, end of 2012. And it was after that we had a beer and he told me about Derek and saw it, seeing if I'd be interested in working on that. So ended up writing and working with him on Derek. And we're both sort of like failed musicians. So we just start writing little songs together, trying to make each other laugh, you know? around his office or at his house or whatever. And that's when we wrote Equality Street. And Richard Curtis approached him to do something for Comic Relief 2013. And Ricky called me and he was like, "What? See that song?" He's like, "What if we do it? What if I do it as Brent? Like, we just bring Brent back." He's like, "You know, it'll just kickstart your career. Like, we just bring Brent back, and you're like the star of it." And I was like, "What?" I couldn't quite believe it. So we shot this video in January 2013. And, you know, most of the time, Comic Relief is not fucking funny. You know that, right? You ever watch that Telephone? Whatever, yeah. It's always shit, man. It's always just like actors thinking they can do comedy. Fuck off. Let's do a version of whatever the show, whatever the fuck. Old white people in corsets. Let's do a version of that, but it's like a funny version. Yeah, imagine. And we did it, and it just killed the internet. Like bang, people were like, "What? That's hilarious."
It was clear there was such a brilliant chemistry between you two.
Yeah, but we had it going for a minute there. It was good. And we do gigs in character, you know, like musical gigs in character. It was a lot of fun. And we shot loads of cool stuff, man. The movie was probably the most fun I've had on a film set ever.
Oh, yes, that's is it Life on the Road it was called?
Yeah, you know, it's not people's favourite film, but I don't really care about that. I'm just glad it wasn't complete shit, do you know what I mean? I'd hate for the first movie I did to be rubbish. But actually, my track record, as tiny as it is pretty much, it's pretty class. Like, the first film I worked on was Attack the Block, which is an amazing film.
Do you know what I like about you, Ben, is that you just say, "Oh, that was a good thing that I did." You know how people tend to be a bit, they sort of skirt around it a bit because they feel it's a sort of polite thing to do or make them seem likeable. To say, "Oh, well, it wasn't very good." You know, so I wrote a book and I have a habit. Some say, "I loved your book." I'll say, "Oh, it was just a..." And it's really, you have to teach yourself to say, "Thank you. I was proud of that piece of work."
Absolutely. And you've got to be honest with yourself when it's shit as well. And I think if you can do those two things, which is easy to do if you keep the same people around you. I've not really made any new friends, you know, since being in show business. So I've still got the same people around
me.
And they just tell you, they tell you how it is, man. And they know when you're getting too big for your boots.
And you've been with your other half for a long time, haven't you?
Yeah. We met at a youth club. I should stress that she was a staff member, not a child.
What was your impression of her when you first met her? Did you really have a feeling?
I knew she didn't like me. I knew she didn't like me at all. I knew exactly what she thought of me, and I was right. She thought I was arrogant, selfish, self-absorbed. She was spot on, but she's a good judge of character like that.
So did you have to sort of win her over?
Yeah, definitely.
Did you?
Yeah. Yeah, it was worth it. She has the power and the intelligence and most of all the empathy to make me a better person. And that's not like, you know, grinding your other half down to the nub that you think is acceptable, which women get accused of doing a lot. It's not that. It's more like there's something missing from all of us, right? And if someone else can bring some of that missing piece to make you more of a whole, that's, you know, that's a valuable person to have on your team. She cares about people. She gives a shit. She tries to do the best by herself and other people every single day. She's such a positive person. She's a teacher, you know, it's the best possible position for someone with that demeanor and that outlook. And you don't often meet people like that because people are generally quite self-motivated, you know. And isolation, I don't think, has helped that. You know, people are very kind of like, "Fuck everybody but me."
And also,
and there's a lot of dishonesty, you know.
How nice that you've been with her this length of time. So you just know there's a real purity to that in the business you're in, I think.
Yeah, and it's not easy. It's not an easy thing to maintain. Relationships are really, really complicated and they require a lot of hard work and MOTs and stuff like that. Mm. Sometimes you just let them drift or you let a resentment build, you know. Those are the things that danger every single relationship. So you've got to be on it. You've got to be on it. But yeah, the main thing is just keep being grateful and be reminded that other people can make you better, you know. Empathy is the key.
You started writing kids' books, which are really lovely, actually, because you've worked a lot. You did the bedtime stories.
Yeah.
That was a big deal.
That was a huge deal. I really wanted to get on that show, but it's fucking hard to get on that show. Like, Judi Dench was in front of me. I thought they'd be, like, so, you know, like, oh, my God, like, he's actually asked if he can be on it. We've been trying to get him on this for years. No, no. Motherfuckers are queuing up to get on Betsy Beebe's Bedtime Stories.
Didn't Tom Hardy do it?
Tom Hardy done it. Do you know what I mean? So I knew it was a big deal. I was only doing it for my kids, though, at the time. I didn't realise what a big thing it was.
Yeah.
But I thought it'd be a big deal for my kids. But it took me so long to get up the queue to, like, Judi Dench that by the time I was on it, my kids were too old to give a shit. They didn't care.
And so your new book, which is coming out in June.
Yeah.
And it's called?
It's called Something I Said.
Something I Said.
It comes out on June the 10th, which is the same day that my mum is publishing her first novel. How bizarre is that? Complete and utter coincidence. Not like some plan that we had or anything. It's just mad.
And what's your...
Have aligned.
We need to talk about your book, but tell me about your mum's book.
It's called The Day I Fell Off My Island, and it charts the journey of this teenage girl from Jamaica to here, and the family complications and the inherited trauma that is buzzing around sort of gives you an idea of late contemporary Jamaican culture, but also like early contemporary Black British culture. It just shows you a bit of both of those, and it's funny as well.
And your book is called?
Something I Said. It's on Bloomsbury. It was what they call a middle grade novel. So I just wrote it like an adult novel kids, really. It feels like a family movie. That's what it feels like. It feels like a good contemporary family movie. It's very real world. There's no dragons. There's no fantasy. There's no portal to another dimension.
Is there stand-up or comedy?
There is some stand-up in it. It's about a kid who's like nearly 13 who through various contrivances ends up doing stand-up in a very sort of organic way, but it's kind of a response to what's going on in his life, but yeah, it ends up on a big sort of epic journey for him in the literal sense, because he goes to America, but it's a circular story that brings him back home to his place in Camden, where he starts to realize how much of his life was actually falling apart, you know. It just took him a really weird journey to work it out. So it's kind of like a wholesome family comedy.
Did you like writing it?
No, I hate it. Like, writing is horrible.
Isn't
like,
it?
To have to do that, like, it's so hard. Like, having the proof in my hands is incredible. Really is. But yeah, the process of it, oh my God, I wish it were my worst enemy. Tedious.
You've said, haven't you, that you're... Because Zadie, obviously...
I don't know how she does it.
Really?
Nah. It's like magic. It's like close-up magic. Like, you know it's happening. It's happening in front of your eyes, but you just can't work out how it's being done. What's the trick? It's just what she does, man. It's different. It's not what I do, you know what I mean? It's something that I try.
What did you think when she first got it so successful? Were you aware when you first read her stuff? Did you think there's something really special here?
Yeah, it was no surprise. It was amazing the heights it got to. For her to be like at one time maybe the biggest author in the world. But it was no surprise like that she delivered something amazing, because she was a freak of nature from an early age, you know. The speed that she was reading novels as a little child, you know, scary speed reading. And then, you know, she just wanted to write. With like a 12th birthday, we got her a typewriter and she tried to write a novel on it. Do you know what I mean? At 12 years old. And then at fifth, I think she was 14 or 15, and she won like a writing competition for Just 17. Remember that magazine for girls? She was like the guest, like fan editor. She edited a whole issue of that. So when she was like 14 or 15.
Even before that, like when she was 8, she came second in a national writing competition sponsored by Smarties. And the face of it was this character, Dr. Smarty Pants, who was an alter ego of Michael Rosen. So Michael Rosen was kind of the face of it in character, Dr. Smarty Pants. And she came second in a national writing competition. It was like all on TV and that. You know, we had a photo of her with Michael Rosen wearing the Dr. Smarty Pants glasses and these big blue frames and the doctor's jacket, you know, hand on the shoulder kind of thing, doing a silly face. And that's always been on, you know, how everybody from the 80s, they've got those collages in their kitchen, you know, all the cutout photos behind a frame of glass. It's at the bottom of that. I always look at it. And then obviously getting into like writing for kids, I see, we've got this one booking coming up a couple years back, it's maybe 2018 or 19, at a book festival in Cheltenham. Mm. So I go there and I see on the lineup Michael Rosen's going to be there. So when I saw him, I suddenly lost my nerve and I didn't speak to him. And then I went into the toilet just before I went on stage and he came in. And then, because it was just the two of us, it's the men's, not really a best place to start conversation. But I said, hey, 1980, whatever it was, 1982, 1983, I got a photo of you in my kitchen. Like, and you ran this Dr. Smarty Pants, Smarty's like best children's writer competition. And he was like, oh, I remember that. He goes, I still got the glasses. I showed him because I'd taken a picture, having seen that he was going to be there before. I'd taken a picture when I was at my mum's and had it on my phone. And I was like, look at that. I still got the photo. And he was like, wow. I said, see that girl there? She came second. And he was like, oh, bless. And I was like, yes, my sister. I said, bless. I said, she is now the world-renowned author, Zadie Smith. And one of her first inspirations at the earliest possible age was you. And he was just like, fuck, yeah, no.
It feels like nothing but a positive thing that Zadie's success was simply a total inspiration for you.
Yeah, the thing that made me think, right, anything is possible. It is possible to just live off your ideas. Mm. That thing that was always in the back of my mind. Yeah. And yet, you know, for another 7 years after White Teeth, I was still just doing youth work. But it was in the back of my mind every day, you belong somewhere else. The thing was, I actually really enjoyed youth work. So it wasn't like I was in Next for 7 years going, oh, I've got to get out of here. You're finished. It wasn't like that at all. I really loved that job and I'm still in touch with that organisation that I worked with and still see the kids. They're all adults now. And it was a wrench to leave when I realised I can't do this and stand up. It's too hard. Mm. But I had no fear going in stand up and thinking I'll make a living from it because of Zadie, because of like, look, you can do this. Like when you go into my mum's house, you go into the living room, there's a bookshelf and it's just got hundreds of copies of White Teeth and On Beauty, like in like hundreds of different languages. It's just got all the different releases. And you go in, you see that and you think, that's it, isn't it? Your ideas can travel the world in some form. Mm. And you can share ideas and have other people go, yes, that's what the fuck I feel. Mm. You know, connection is everything. And you go and you see that and you're like, anything's possible. Anything's possible.
You were saying you lost your dad?
Yeah, 2006.
I'm really sorry. Yeah. That must have been tough.
Yeah, it was, you know, I cried when I heard, but then I was very much like, right, down to business, because Zadie was still living in New York and he didn't speak to his other son. And you know, I was the one who was nearest by to just sort things out. So I was you hear this from a lot of people, like they become quite businesslike in the days following loss. It sort of keeps the wolf at the door. That's what I realised, because it wasn't until the funeral itself when I spoke, I was just a mess trying to speak. I couldn't speak. I was a mess. Yeah. That's when it hit me. And it's mad because I really met my other brother that day. I'd only met him once before, like when I was like 3 years old. Yeah, yeah. And they'd not spoken for, you know, a generation. And I actually met him then and got on really well. Yeah, and then like his son and me, we're actually quite close. It's funny how, like, you know, all those things of the past, you inherit them. And when you meet the next generation, you're like, the only reason I don't speak to you is to other people's issue. Like, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
So, yeah, in a weird way, his death brought about a more of a closeness with certain people.
I have therapy, and I'm really quite evangelical about it because I think it's a good thing to do.
Yeah, it's a great thing to do.
Do you have therapy, or have you had it?
Miko, shush.
It's because that boy had a big stick.
Yeah. I think everybody should at least try it, man. Like, why not? Like, it's like we were saying earlier about, like, your problems. When you say them out loud and someone else goes, oh, yeah, I've done that, or I've had that, or my mate's done that. It immediately doesn't belittle them. It immediately just makes them a bit more manageable because you've just said it out loud. Mm. There's a Chinese saying, because you know how you stack up your problems? And they say, like, if it's a problem you can fix, then why worry? Yeah. If it's a problem you can't fix, then why worry? Because, like, you can't fix it. So it's reminiscent of the Serenity Prayer, isn't it? Where they say, like...
Yeah. The wisdom to know the difference.
The wisdom to know the difference, the changes, you know, like, what you can and can't change. Like, what's out of your control, what's out of your power.
You're not a people pleaser. I'm saying that I don't know. Are you a people pleaser?
I think everybody's a people pleaser to some extent, you know. It's very rare that you get the same face of a person everywhere they go. Those type of people, like my wife's like that, you know, those type of people who are just the same with absolutely everyone.
Is she? Yeah,
they're amazing. Those are good people, right?
How are you with confrontation then? Do you...
No, I don't like that. Who likes confrontation? Like, that's what
Donald
you, like,
Trump.
Yeah, but he's not British. Like, if you're British, like, it's got to be the number one thing you're trying to avoid with every second, every inch of your being. Like, the confrontational people in my life, like, they're amazing. They're, like, they're unique people. They've got this, like, incredible skill. I don't know how they do it. You know those people who are just like, no, fuck that. You know those people? Wait, no, fuck that. Like, well, he just pushed in front. Maybe he's in a hurry. No, fuck that. Yo. Boss man, come in. Bruv, you see, you just stepped in front of my bridge, innit? Oh no, I was just going. Oh, you're fucking babbling now, bruv. Get the fuck to the back of the queue. Everyone in the queue be like, yay! I look at those people as like magicians, don't you? Those people just know what to say in the moment.
Yeah, but
in a confrontation.
I'm the person in the back of the queue going, yay!
Yeah, I'm just another bod in the queue clapping. I'm not that guy. Let me tell you how bad my confrontation skills are, right? There was one time. I wanted to take my brother to this teppanyaki place in Camden. You know where they prepare the food on the hot plate in front of you? They're like you're at the bench and they're cooking some incredible Japanese shit on the on that hot plate.
Yeah.
It's a hot table thing. It was mad expensive, but I saw they had a 2-for-1 night. So I said, let's go on 2-for-1 night. And then we can like properly just taste everything and have some booze. So we went and it was good. And the bill came, and I was like, what the fuck? Like, I was thinking it's gonna be like £150 max, like maybe £100, I don't know, somewhere in that zone. And it was like £240. And I was like, what the fuck? I called the waiter over, and I was like, you've got the bill wrong. He's like, I didn't spend nearly that. Like, it's at least half that. And he was like, no, that's the right, it's correct. And I was like, well, can I speak to the manager then? And the manager comes out, and I'm like worked up at this point. And I'm like, you're trying to rip me off like 240 quid. I was adding it up as I went. It should at least be about half that, if anything. Should be 130 max. And he goes, I was like, yeah. And I was like, you know, it's 2-for-1. You're trying to like do it. You're trying to kill me here. And he was like, 2-for-1 Tuesday. Today, Wednesday. And you know when you're already up, like you're already up. You're on, you know, so you're loud and people are looking at you. And you have to do such an immediate climb down. I couldn't climb down straight away. So I was like, yeah, well, you know, should be a Wednesday. Should be a Wednesday. Because more people want to do something because it's hump day. So you've got the day wrong.
Oh, there's an Alsatian. See, I'm a bit older than you, Ben, so I grew up in the 70s, and they always were very 70s dog, the Alsatian.
Well, she loves a coffee.
She, me
Yeah, she's just taken the empty coffee cup out of her hand.
I thought she was giving me an affectionate kiss. She knocked the coffee out of my hand.
Outrageous.
Did you have animals growing up?
No. No, and I think that's why I always wanted one. You always want what you don't have, innit? So we've had a cat for a while and went all in and got the dog. And yes, they do hate each other.
And why did you... So you didn't... Your parents weren't really pet people?
Nah. You know, in Jamaica, like, an animal works. You don't just have an animal sitting around doing fuck all, not earning its keep, and you're paying for it. You're giving money to the fucker. What? No, he's supposed to be earning you money. So that relationship was a non-starter. And then with my dad's family, I don't know, like... I think you probably did get a lot of dogs with working class families, but I just don't think he grew up with dogs, so it just wasn't on his agenda. But yeah, my mum was, she was proper anti-animal, like, they work for you and then you eat them. That's it.
And what do your friends say in terms of, you know, I always think you have certain friends that you think, I call Ben when dot, dot, dot.
Mm.
What would the answer to that question be, do you think? If you asked your friends, what do I provide for you?
Yeah, I hope I like to think I'm the guy who, like, does try and check up on people, do you know what I mean? Like, with my close friends, you know how it is with close friends, you just fucking never see them, you know? Even before the pandemic, you know, it's not like the old days when you're young and you're just hooking up all the time, you know? So friendship changes, but it's important to keep those day one people there because they know you way better than you think, you know? So they're good people to have around. And yeah, I would like to think they'd say, oh yeah, he does, you know, he shouts me and he'll sort out a get together.
Are you quite a good in a crisis, do you think? Are you someone a friend would call and say, I've got this problem?
Yeah. That happened on Thursday. Yeah.
Did it?
It happened just last week. So I'd say the answer to that is I'm quite a cool head.
Yeah, I can
but,
see that.
But like I said, the confrontation thing, I'm not like necessarily like the best in an emergency.
You're
emergency.
Not let's roll.
I'm not let's roll, no. I'm like, let's think. Hold on, let's have a think about this. Or let's talk. Mika, come on. Come on, Meeks, we're nearly there.
We've got to go.
Have you just run out of batteries? Hey, come here.
I'm really looking forward to getting your book for my niece because I think
the book I'm super proud of, man. Like, the book is
brilliant.
I can't wait for it to come out. I can't wait to do readings.
Do you think it's nice as well that kids, you get such a genuine reaction because they're not thinking, oh, I know who he is, so I'll be nice to him about that thing. They're just saying, I reacted and related to this
thing. My friend's brother... Oh, wow, look at that. My friend's brother, he was doing, like, a kid's comedy thing. Like, he's always tried to get me to do it. He's like, yeah, kids love you. Like, come and do it. I said no every single time.
Yeah.
Just out of the fear of dying in front of kids. Like, it's nothing worse. The way they look at you. Kids don't give a fuck. They ask me to come in and talk to the schools. I remember going into one school and chatting to the kids, they're just looking at me, right? And one, I say, okay, let's open it up and get some questions. And one kid puts his hand up, he goes, if you're famous, how come your trainers ain't new? And I was just like, it's very different, like, writing for kids and actually performing for kids.
Yeah, yeah.
So I actually have started writing bits and pieces specifically for kids, but, you know, you die in front of them, it's painful. They don't business. They will tell you. They'll let you know.
Oh,
right.
I have loved meeting you, and I've really enjoyed our walk.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Ben.
Yeah, pleasure.
Say goodbye.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Thank you so much.
I really hope you enjoyed listening to that, and do remember to rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.